Good afternoon. I'm Hannah Levine. You've got it tuned to the homestretch only here on 91.3 FM KXCI in Tucson, online everywhere at kxci.org. It's just past 4 o'clock, which means it's time to welcome my regular guest. Chris Carey volunteers his time each week to select and research our classic picks. This week, he's coming in with a live recording, which I think is wonderful. We're going to be taking a look at King Curtis live at Fillmore West, recorded right around this time back in 1971. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Hannah. Actually, it was released in August 1971. It was actually recorded in March of 1971. Curtis Owsley, which he goes by the stage name of King Curtis, was born in 1934. A lot of people don't know him by name, but he's huge, and chances are he's played on anybody listening knows very well and or loves. He's kind of considered one of the greatest R&B, rock, funk, and soul jazz sax players of all time. He was a band leader, a session musician, a record producer, and a solo recording artist. He played tenor, alto, and soprano sax excellently. He also played guitar. He started playing saxophone at the age of 12, primarily influenced by jazz and R&B. Like most sax players, I think it started doing that. In high school, he played in various bands and learned how to write and arrange music. And actually, he turned down a pretty good full ride kind of college scholarship because he wanted to move to New York City. Like I said, he was born in Texas, and he wanted to move to New York City and make his way as a musician. And he went up there at 18, and within weeks, he found work as a session musician. Initially, he did mostly session work on jazz recordings, but he soon realized there was more work, and it paid better, to work on rock, soul, and R&B records. And during this time, he actually ended up recording quite a bit with the Coasters, and he played all the sax parts to some of the biggest early 60s songs by the Coasters. I mean, he's responsible for the sax riff and Yakety Yak and Charlie Brown.
Oh, wow. And,
yeah.
Love the Coasters.
Yeah, the Coasters are great. And they were on ATCO/Atlantic Records at the time. Then when Atlantic realized that he did a lot of stuff on his own, they actually gave him a recording contract in 1958. And he had his first hit in 1962 with a song called Soul Twist. And again, this is instrumental R&B, which is pretty cool because there's not a lot of instrumental R&B. That was kind of like this thing. In the 60s, there were a fair amount of bands doing instrumental R&B, and I don't know why that hasn't been more of a thing, because I really enjoy it. You got, you know, bands like the Marquees and Booker T and the MGs, and a lot of stuff that King Curtis did was this instrumental R&B stuff. And King Curtis, on a lot of his records, did a lot of covers, but he did some originals. And like I said, that Soul Twist was his first hit. It was an original in 1962. He had another hit in 1964 with Soul Serenade and Memphis Soul Stew, and also a cover of Ode to Billy Joe. And that was, of course, Bobby Gentry's single. So this whole time, he was doing his own stuff and playing with a lot of other artists and playing as a session musician. And by 1967, Jerry Wexler really took notice of him. And as we've talked about Jerry Wexler a lot in this show, Jerry Wexler was a former music writer who ended up becoming the CEO at Atlantic. He's the guy who actually coined the term rhythm and blues. And he's responsible for some of the biggest acts from the 1960s through the 80s that he signed. I mean, on top of discovering King Curtis and giving him his own recording contract, he also discovered Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles, Allman Brothers, Led Zeppelin, Wilson Pickett, Dire Straits, Dusty Springfield, and Bob Dylan, among many, many others. He's a big part of developing music in the 60s and 70s. Anyway, Wexler saw Curtis's talent not only as a saxophone player, but as an arranger and a composer and a musician. And he actually used him a lot more to work with artists. He would do compositions for them. He would arrange for them. Sometimes he produced or co-produced, as well as a studio musician. And at this time, he also was kind of in charge of forming Aretha Franklin's backing band, which was known as the Kingpins at that time. And so King Curtis was running Aretha Franklin's band from 1967 through 1970. So all the most amazing, highly praised Aretha Franklin albums were albums that King Curtis played on. You know, that's like I've Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You in 1967, Aretha Rives in 67, Lady Soul, Aretha Now, all of these amazing Aretha Franklin records, King Curtis was playing sax on there. So like from 1967 to 1971, along with working with Aretha Franklin, he did all this other stuff. By 1970, 71, King Curtis obviously would be touring with Aretha Franklin. And in 1971, he was actually touring with Aretha Franklin. King Curtis, with his band, would open the shows, and then they would then back Aretha Franklin, kind of real similar to what Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings did.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, with the Dap Kings opening and then backing her, was totally modeled on King Curtis and the Kingpins opening and then backing Aretha Franklin. So in March 5th through 7th, 1971, Aretha Franklin and King Curtis had booked three dates at the Fillmore West in San Francisco. And what's really cool is this same time, not only did King Curtis record his album live at the Fillmore West, off these same three dates, Aretha Franklin recorded her 71 album live at the Fillmore West. And so both of those artists recorded two albums on these three dates. And if I had a time machine and I could go back in time, one of these three dates would be one of the first live shows I would go through with a time show, where you could see King Curtis open and then Aretha Franklin. And what's cool about this is that the personnel on this record was amazing. Everybody on stage was like the pinnacle of studio musicians that were working in the country at the time. And this included the Memphis Horns, which basically were the studio horn players for Stax Records between 1967 and 72. So like those guys were like on literally nearly every record that came out of Stax. The horn section that is on this record was recording. So like all those Otis Redding albums, Solomon Burke records, Sam and Dave records, this was the horn section. So Memphis Horns were great. And some critics have gone as far as to say they might have been the best horn section ever assembled by anyone at any time.
I was going to say, so basically all of the best players firing on all cylinders.
Yeah,
just at the time.
And then the Memphis Horns toured with King Curtis and Aretha Franklin. But then at this particular shows, Billy Preston showed up and played Hammond B3 for the shows too. So you've got Billy Preston on this playing Hammond B3, which is amazing. And then the Memphis Horn section, and then all these other great musicians. And then King Curtis, who himself is probably one of the best saxophone players of all time, maybe the best in rock and R&B. And like I said, this was at the Fillmore West. And I should note that the Fillmore West was a famous venue that was ran by the famous concert promoter Bill Graham from 1968 to 71. And while Bill Graham was also tied into the Fillmore West was actually in a slightly different location, a few blocks away from where the current Fillmore is. And the Fillmore West was only open from 1968 to 1971, the same time frame that the Fillmore East in New York was opened. And then Bill Graham, after a few years, he closed those down and did some other stuff. But the Fillmore West was famous because that's kind of where a lot of the Haight-Ashbury stuff in the late 60s got started, like Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane, Janis Joplin, Big Brother and Holding Company, and the Quicksilver Messenger Service all got their start at the Fillmore West. So by this time, King Curtis has really developed a really cool career where he's doing studio work, he's doing arrangement work, he's composing, he's producing, and he's recording. And then by the time he's working and touring with Aretha Franklin, his career's really taken off. It's really mushrooming. He played a really famous set at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1971. He composed and recorded the theme for the Soul Train show in 1971. He actually contributed some tracks to John Lennon's Imagine in 1971. And that was the climate in which they recorded this record. And so King Curtis, who's already pretty big in kind of an underground way within the industry, was poised to get really big. This was about the time when this record was released in early August, you know, just a few months after it was recorded, King Curtis actually was murdered. And it's a real shame.
No.
There was nothing sketchy about it. The guy, he lived in Manhattan. He'd come home. He'd bought a new air conditioning window unit and was trying to get it in his front door. And there was two drug dealers that were kind of loitering on his stoop. And he asked them to leave and a fight ensued. And one of them stabbed him. And the guy ended up pleading down to manslaughter. And this guy who killed this, you know, this huge figure in R&B ended up only serving 5 years. I mean, it's really tragic. King Curtis was only 37 years old at the time. This record came out, and a day after King Curtis died, this LP peaked at number 54 on the Billboard 200 chart, which is huge for an R&B record at the time, specifically for a record that was almost all instrumental. And it ended up being the best-selling album of his solo career. At his funeral, which happened a week or so after he was killed, the services were led by none other than Jesse Jackson, Aretha Franklin, Stevie Wonder, Sissy Houston, Duane Allman, and several other really well-known acts showed up to that funeral. And Duane Allman, who was a big fan and a friend of King Curtis, it's interesting because he only died 2 months later in a motorcycle wreck after this funeral. Both Aretha Franklin and Stevie Wonder both performed at the funeral. You know, to kind of sum it up is like King Curtis is one of those guys that even if you don't know, you know, because he's played on so many, like almost all of the really hooky saxophone riffs on anything that Aretha Franklin did from like 67 to 1970. That's King Curtis. You know, he did the stuff with the Coasters, played with a ton of other artists. He worked with, recorded, played with acts like Buddy Holly, Louis Armstrong, Otis Redding, Herbie Mann, Fats Domino, Wilson Pickett, Solomon Burke, Quincy Jones, Lou Rawls, Junior Walker, Jimmy Cliff, Roberta Flack, Eric Clapton, Donnie Hathaway, country artists like George Jones, Waylon Jennings, and even Andy Williams. And then, of course, he ended up playing with John Lennon, too. So the guy was, for somebody who's not as well known as he is, he's pretty huge. Inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. He's somebody to really get to know, and he's got a lot of material out there, not just stuff that is got his name on it, but I've got several of his records, and like they are the kind of albums that when you listen to, the more you listen to, they just keep opening up.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Hannah.